I said, well, what are we going to do? He says, we're going to go to Mexico City, and we're going to break the 200, the 500, and the kilometer. And I'm like, okay.
Welcome to the Canadian Cycling Magazine podcast. I'm Matthew Piero, editor of the magazine and host of the pod. Months ago, I began planning coverage for the Tokyo Olympic Games for the magazine and our website. I was looking to cover the regular Olympic stuff, like, is the road course the right kind of hilly for Michael Woods? Or who will actually be on the women's cross-country team out of Haley Smith, Emily Batty, and Catherine Pendrell? Will Tara Whitten magically appear for her third Olympics in a row? One story that would have had minor coverage would be an Olympic Games that Canada missed. It was about this time, 40 years ago, that Canadian athletes were coming to terms with a boycott of the Moscow Games, which had just been made official. The story was going to be a little something about global events affecting sport. Just some history, right? For about 48 hours in March, it looked like Canadians would miss another Olympics. The International Olympic Committee was humming and hawing about what to do over Tokyo 2020 as the world was in lockdown because of the COVID-19 outbreak. On March 22nd, the Canadian Olympic Committee and the Canadian Paralympic Committee showed some leadership by announcing that Canadians would not go to the Games this summer. 2 days later, the IOC said it would postpone the 2020 Olympics for roughly a year. Good news, right? Well, things are still in flux. At the end of April, Yoshitake Yokokura of the Japan Medical Association mused that the Olympics might not happen without an effective COVID-19 vaccine available. Yoshiro Mori, president of Japan's Olympic Organizing Committee, said the Games wouldn't be postponed a second time. With the threat of cancellation creeping back in, I figured there may be some lessons from athletes who went through the 1980 boycott. They might have something for the athletes facing uncertainty today. In December 1979, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. It may not seem like a global event that would affect Canadian cyclists, but in mid-January, its effects started coming to North America. U.S. President Jimmy Carter called for a boycott of the 1980 Summer Olympics in Moscow if the Soviet Union didn't pull out of Afghanistan by February 20th. In March, Carter announced that no U.S. athlete would be heading to the Games. By the end of April, the Canadian government of Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, as well as the Canadian Olympic Association, supported the U.S.'s position. That was it. No Olympics for Canucks. I first spoke with track sprinter Gordon Singleton about how he dealt with the boycott. When Singleton missed the Moscow Games, he got creative. I saw him at the Track World Cup in Milton in January. It seems like a different time now. We were all looking ahead to Tokyo 2020. COVID-19 wasn't something that seemed to affect us.
Hi, my name is Gordon Singleton, and I competed in the 1976 Montreal Olympics. I was also a member of the Canadian 1980 Olympic team. We were all inflicted by the boycott, so we didn't get to go, but I was on that Olympic team. In lieu of the fact that we didn't go to the Olympics in Moscow, I broke 3 world records in Mexico City.
That's a productive time away from the Olympics, I would say.
Yes, and it was an interesting story because it was when the Canadian government realized that Canada didn't get to go to the Olympics. They took approximately 20 of our top medal hopes, and they funded any project or any World Cup or anything they wanted to go to. Well, in cycling, after the Olympics in 1980, the season was finished. And so I didn't know what to do. And my cycling coach was from Great Britain, and I remember calling him up, and he was an overachiever. And I called him up and I said, I'd like to go to Mexico City and break the 200-meter world record. And he says, we're not doing that. What are we going to do? Well, I told him the government was going to pay for it. And he says, I said, well, what are we going to do? He says, we're going to go to Mexico City and we're going to break the 200, the 500, and the kilometer. And I'm like, okay. So anyways, he came over to Canada and North America, and we prepared for the final 3 months up to October of that year, 1980. We went to Mexico City. And when we did it, this is the story. It wasn't in an atmosphere like tonight where there's all these screaming fans. It was on a Tuesday morning in the middle, and there was nobody there. And I had to get up on the track and say, okay, go break a world record.
Where do you find the motivation for that if there isn't this vibe like we have here at Milton tonight,
well,
at a World Cup?
I think the motivation came from just the fact that, you know, I wanted to achieve, and it was something once I set my mind to, it's like I'd really like to try and accomplish that. And my training building up to it really showed that, like, this is a possibility, you know, and my results were there. So we went and we did it. I say we because I wasn't, it was me, I rode the bike, but I had some help. I had my coach, and I had helpers and mechanics and things like that. So, yeah, we as a team, we went to do it.
Weeks after I spoke with Singleton, the Olympics were postponed. I could see similarities and differences between today and what happened 40 years ago. Roughly 4 months away from the Games, athletes had their plans all messed up. For the riders of today, safety was a big reason for postponing the Games. Also, even if the Olympics could have run in July, what kind of competition would it be, populated with athletes who weren't able to train because of lockdowns? But there was the hope that things would simply be delayed a year. Maybe everything would be fine, just later. But all-out cancellation still loomed. Back in 1980, it wasn't a health crisis. It was politics. The U.S. and Canada and other like-minded countries wanted to wreck the Moscow Games. If enough countries pulled out of the Olympics, it would embarrass the Soviet Union. All of the effort that the country put into the Olympics would be for nothing. Canada, the U.S., and others hoped those games would, essentially, be worthless. To find out more about what the boycott meant for other Canadian cyclists, I spoke with Steve Bauer and Louis Garneau. Canada was trying to wreck the games. In the process, it had wrecked the Olympic dreams of its athletes.
We'd been team pursuing, you know, as a group since, when I was a junior, 1977. Commonwealth Games, Pan American Games in 79, I believe, I think they were in Puerto Rico. And so, yeah, we'd actually had a core group of guys that were, you know, solid team pursuers, and we'd had some success internationally.
That's Steve Bauer. You no doubt know him from his silver at the 84 Olympics, his stints in the yellow jersey at the 1988 and 1990 Tours de France, and many more significant performances on the road. But in the late 70s, Bauer was focused on the track, together with riders such as Gary Trevisiol, Peter Suderman, and Claude Langlois.
And so that was the goal, you know, the goal to race in the Olympics and then team pursuit. You know, obviously a big task against the Eastern Bloc countries at the time, but like any athlete's dreams to have a shot at the Olympic Games was where we were headed.
Okay, 1980, first of all, I had 21 years old.
That's Louis Garneau. Today, he's the president of the cycling clothing and equipment company that bears his name. Back then, he was a young rider who wasn't really dialed into global politics at all.
Just to give you an idea, I started racing in 1972. So at the beginning, I was not a great racer, you know, and I started to progress in 1976, you know, junior was a good sign for me. I won almost all the races in Quebec, and I race also in Canada. So I did pretty well. You know, when you're a cyclist, you're 19, 20 years old, you know, you don't check too much politics, you know, what's happening in the world. When you are a cyclist, your ego is very big. You know, you look for yourself, you know, and you look to... Because at this time, imagine that you don't have cell phone, you don't have computer, you don't have, you know, iPhone. you don't have zero information except the newspaper. So if you don't look to the newspaper or check the TV, you don't know too much about that. At this time, my preoccupation was more to race, to take care of my performance, you know, and I was only in love with the bike, so I didn't take care about all the politics.
Garneau was headed for the Games, but a call from his coach informed him that their plans for Moscow wouldn't go ahead. Garneau was disappointed and got a lesson on politics and sport.
But I was also surprised why the government used us athletes, you know, to contest a decision. So I just remember my frustration at this time, and I said, I don't understand why you use athletes, and you can maybe use other things than small athletes, you know, like us. And we are not part of that. You know, we do cycling because we enjoy, and, you know, racing, it's another thing. But I just realized at this time, at 21 years old, Olympic Games is also a politic games.
You know, you're angry that politics come in the way of sport. But they're sort of part and parcel, and even, you know, to this day, we understand that a little bit even more of how politics and power and, you know, financial resources influence sport tremendously. That's just the way the world turns, so to speak. And at the time, it's you just don't understand it, really. You're just angry with the situation, and the why it happened is sort of not understandable. You know, as a young age, you just don't understand it.
I asked both Bauer and Garneau if anything good came out of the boycott. No, nothing. For Bauer, he lost time and experience. Same for Garneau. But for Garneau, he does remember some important words from his mother, which became his motto and the title of his book, Never Give Up.
The only thing I can say that was positive for me personally, because at the end, if the government didn't do the Olympic Games, you know, we didn't win nothing, you know. In 1984, the Russians decided to don't come to LA. I think everybody lost time. I think everybody lost good time, you know, when we talk about athletes. And I don't think we changed a lot of things for the politics or for the government. So, but the only thing it's positive with the boycott of 1980 was my motto, never give up, my Louis. And try again, and you will win in 84. You're going to make the selection. So this is my good memory. This is my best souvenir for the boycott, because the rest, it's pretty negative.
You know, I was still a young athlete, so it wasn't sort of the end of the world, right? It wasn't like an athlete in my prime. Would our team pursuit team had a shot at a medal at the Olympic Games? Likely not. But, you know, the participation experience would have sort of thrust us in a different realm, I suppose. I continued to race on the track for the next couple of years through doing participating world championships. And then, you know, gradually transitioning to the road. I think my first road world championships was in Goodwood, England. So I did track and road that year, and then you know, eventually transitioning completely to road racing by 84, and then turning pro. So you can see the evolution of, you know, a team pursuiter track athlete. As I began to understand that my strength was on the road, or, you know, as I matured as an athlete, then I transitioned to the road racing 100%.
Bauer was able to keep racing and building his cycling career. Garneau had slightly different plans. Even though he was young too, he didn't feel as if he had as much time left as a competitive cyclist. Still, he couldn't let go of the Olympics.
After that, I said, okay, I forget about that, and I'm gonna, again, never give up. I'm gonna try to do another selection, because it's not easy to do another selection. You know, you need the perfect timing, And I had the chance to do that because I said, after the Olympic Games 1984, I'm going to quit. I want to do another thing in my life. And I decided also to start my company, Louis Garneau Companies, in 1983, just one year before the Olympic Games. So I have a real plan, very serious. And I said, okay, I'm going to go. And then I'm going to do another thing in my life. You know, my goal was not to be a cyclist for the rest of my life. You're like a competitor. I'm a cyclist, but not a racer until 40 years old. And I said, I want to start the business. Business is like a bike racing. But the problem with the business, it has no finish line. It's all the time. You can work 7 days a week. You have no rest. And you can burn yourself, or you can perform, you can do very well, you can win at the international. You can also fail, like right now we have a bad period, but we will come back and survive because I have the same attitude than 1980. I missed the Olympic Games, but I said I never give up, and then I'm going to try again for the next 4 years, and I'm going to make the Olympic Games. This is it.
Garneau, Bauer, and Singleton all found strategies for coping with the Olympic boycott of 1980. Singleton was able to get creative. His was a masterful pivot. He couldn't win medals, so he just broke world records. Bauer, with his, well, what can you do and roll with the punches attitude, and his youth, kept plugging along until the next Olympics. Garneau seems more the planner, but his story highlights a feature all Olympic athletes have, that is, determination. It got him through the difficult times. The qualities that all of these athletes showed 40 years ago are qualities today's athletes can turn to, with all of the uncertainty that they continue to face. This past summer, we featured a conversation with Lonnie Hull, the founder of Structure Cycle Works in Calgary. Recently, Canadian cycling magazine mountain bike editor Terry McCall reconnected with the bike maker. In this interview brought to you by Structure Cycle Works, Hull delves into his innovative mountain bike frame. It has a front linkage system instead of a telescoping fork. You have to see this thing, after you finish listening to this episode, of course. The system on the bike is called WTF. So the acronym is obvious, right? WTF, which is without telescoping fork. Hull explains the WTF's performance benefits and what new bikes we can expect from the Calgary company in the future.
My name is Lonnie Hull. I am the founder and CEO of Structure Cycle Works in Calgary, Alberta, and invented a linkage suspension system that we're using on the Structure SCW1 bicycle.
Like, what has the response been to the bike so far?
At first, there were a lot of questions. People didn't entirely get it. Many people look at the bike and they just see a complex assembly of linkages and they don't know why it needs to exist and what it does, and perhaps can't see how it does it better. I took each objection and went straight at it, asking for honest feedback from professionals and strangers alike who rode our demo bikes, taking the bike racing and allowing riders to ride any line they wanted to at Whistler at Crankworx last year. So what we've noticed is that the comments from 2017, when we first revealed the design, to now have gone from "I'd break that thing in a second" or "burn it with fire before it lays eggs" to "my friend wrote it and says it's the future," and even "I think it's beautiful." We think that performance really is beautiful and kind of sets the tone of things to come. So we'll call that progress.
Has there been any unexpected positive reactions or unexpected stories since having the bike released?
My favorite positive is a recurring one. We've had a number of writers at Crankworks, for example, and also at Panorama, race and or ride our bikes all over the mountain and come back with no restrictions from us on which trails they rode and say, I have to admit, I tried to break your bike, but it was awesome. And they'll say it was so fast and composed and balanced. And those moments really crystallize for me why structure exists, why I get up in the morning and go to work, even during crazy times like this with COVID-19 raging around the world.
So the main identifying feature of the structure SEW1 is the front suspension linkage. So with limited demo bikes and opportunities, especially now that you can't have a demo fleet, have you worked around the need to explain why you went with such a different design? I mean, this is kind of keeping in mind that this is something other brands don't really have to do, whether that's fair or not, because many riders might not understand the intricacies of how their own fork works or how their own suspension design works. But since it looks familiar, they trust it.
Telescoping forks are very well developed at this point. And it's gotten, in fact, so far down the line that it's difficult to make a telescoping fork significantly better from last year. When I approached this, I was looking at separating the forces of steering from suspension and braking. And in a telescoping fork system, they're really all tied together. It's one unit that's doing all of those things, sharing those forces, and they do interplay with one another. So to the extent possible, I wanted to separate them. And the only way to do that was through a linkage system. So I view a large part of structure's message to be not that telescoping forks are garbage or that they have no place in the market, but that they have limitations that can't be engineered out. In fact, every single rider I know has learned to ride around those limitations and live with them. We kind of ride the fork, but we've all had over the bars incidents that ended in blood, broken bones, concussions, or even hospitalizations. So there are limits to what telescoping forks can do, and it doesn't really matter how loyal we are to our favorite brands. We have to acknowledge those limits. So my question from the first drawing was, do we have now the materials and manufacturing techniques in 2012 when I started this to finally do front linkage so well that there's a much larger performance envelope available with a lot less chance of going over the bars? And it turns out the answer is absolutely yes. And the best explanation I can give is to shut my mouth and hand a guy a bike.
So are there any plans to develop more bikes or expand Structure's line of bikes? E-band bikes are particularly popular right now, or would you consider putting one of those in the future?
Absolutely. We were on a roll in terms of sales before COVID-19 hit, and we're still here. We're still selling bikes, so we're adapting. And one thing that's really cool is that the interest in what Structure is doing is global. And there's demand for a 29er that we keep hearing, as well as for an EMTB. So we're addressing those requests from people who are interested in linkage suspension by designing bikes that meet those requests. And the future looks bright for the company.
A lot of Structure's parts builds include other Canadian brands like 1UP or We Are One out of Kamloops and Squamish, respectively. How important is it to Structure to kind of support other Canadian companies?
It's a really big deal to me. If we could have built the bike entirely in Canada and supplied it with all Canadian components, I would have found that desirable. But the truth is, we're always going to do what's absolutely best. So we build the best frame we can at the best factory we know of, and that happens to be in Taiwan. And we supply it with the best bar and stem we can find. That happens to be in Canada. We're using We Are One carbon wheels, which I personally believe are the best carbon wheels in the world. And in every case, we look at what the best component is for our application, for the performance we expect, and we go with that. And it really doesn't matter where it comes from if the brand is reputable, doing an outstanding job of engineering and creating the product that we want to make our riders happy.
The structure's WTF link design definitely attracts the most attention, both in the media and in person when people first see the bike. What's one aspect of either the brand or the SCW1 that people might be overlooking?
Obviously, WTF linkage is the big news item, but we're a company of riders who innovate to make bikes better, and we're doing it for riders. If a technology or an innovation genuinely makes biking safer or more comfortable or faster or more accessible or better handling, we will consider it for a future structure product. So in a lot of ways, we're a very serious engineering-minded company, but what we're serious about is sport. It's fun. It's friendly competition. It's the joy of being outside riding a bike. And that was really manifest for me last year at Crankworx when we had a linkage. Actually, one of the hardware connections at the back of the bike had a problem due to an accident. Somebody was demoing a bike. And I went over to the tent of a competing manufacturer and I asked them if they had some hardware that we could use. And they pulled out every drawer in the trailer and found us exactly what we needed. And we got the bike back up and running. And that's the way it should be. We should all be passionate about the sport and happy enough to be on two wheels that it's not specialized against Santa Cruz, against Norco, against Structure, but it's a bunch of guys who love bikes. And we try to bring that kind of DNA to the company and to our bikes. There's really only one company in the world right now that delivers a full linkage carbon bike that will make you want to get out and ride every single day. So in that regard, we feel like we stand out. But you asked what the one thing was that people might be overlooking, and that's that we do it for love.
This interview is brought to you by Structure Cycle Works in Calgary. To learn more about the mountain bike maker and the WTF linkage system, visit structure.bike. And that's the episode. It's put together by me, Matthew Piaro, and mountain bike editor Terry McCall. It's produced by Adam Killick. He composed the music too. I had help from web editor Lily Hansen-Gillis. Thanks to Ontario Creates for its support. And thank you for listening. Please rate and review the show, and I'll talk to you later.